Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A decade after the bloody ethnic war ended in Bosnia, a video has turned up showing the torture and killings of six Bosnian Muslims by Serbian police. Until now, the Serbian government has denied that its police forces were involved in such killings, and the newly public video is forcing many Serbs to confront the popular view that the 1995 massacre of thousands of Muslim men and boys in UN-controlled Srebrenica never happened. Joining us on the line from Belgrade is BBC reporter Matt Proger. Matt, what does this video show?
It's a very graphic video. It lasts for about 15 minutes. It begins with a priest blessing members of a paramilitary unit called the Scorpions before they go into battle. He's placing the crucifix on the forehead of each of them and wishing them luck in their task. The video then moves on to images of Bosnian Muslims men, six civilians from the town of Srebrenica, in the back of a lorry. They are removed from the lorry. Their hands are tied. They're laid on the grass. A gun is fired over their heads. They're then marched along the road by Serbian paramilitaries to a clearing where it then shows them being shot in the bank at point-blank range. As each man is shot, another man is pushed into his place, and then he too is shot. Two men are kept alive merely to dispose of the bodies, to move them to a clearing, and then those two men are also shot. There's very little speaking on the video. In fact, the only emotion displayed on the video is when the cameraman, who's also a member of the paramilitary unit, expresses frustration that the battery on his camera is running down, and he urges the men to get on with the killings.
Fools for taping it, but thank goodness they did. And where did it come from?
We believe that, as I say, this was shot by the Scorpions paramilitary unit. It appears to be a trophy video, a very grim trophy video. We believe that it was passed to a human rights organization in Serbia, a very high-profile human rights organization, very outspoken about Serbia's need to deal with its past. We don't know who passed it on to them, presumably a member of the unit who was feeling some guilt in what had happened. It was then passed on to the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, who on Wednesday used it as evidence in this trial of the former Yugoslav president, Slobodan Milosevic. We believe that the Serbian government also was in possession of the video about 2 weeks ago, and that's why they were able to make at least eight arrests in the past 24 hours of people either in the video or connected to the unit.
Well, and this video was also shown on television in the region for the first time this week. What's been the public response in Serbia, where, as we said, polls show half of the people don't even believe that war crimes ever took place in Srebrenica?
That's right. The most recent survey suggested that most people did not believe that war crimes had taken place at Srebrenica, and that two-thirds of people believed that the men the most wanted in connection with Srebrenica, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, are in fact innocent. The reaction, I've been speaking to people on the streets of Belgrade today, the reaction mainly has been one of horror. One woman I spoke to said, I am absolutely ashamed to have watched this video, but I'm glad that I did. And I am very surprised and shocked that what we were always told were lies by the Western media has turned out to be true. Now, on the other hand, I spoke to a man who said he did not believe this video at all. He said that these men were mercenaries, that they may have been Serbs, but they were paid to do it, and they would have been paid by some Western organization like the CIA. So obviously, some people still finding it hard to come to terms with.
And we understand as well that there are people who are recognizing people they know in the tape.
Yes, one of the more astonishing outcomes of this has been the story of a Bosnian mother who was sitting at home on Wednesday night watching her evening news bulletin when this video was aired. One of the prisoners in the video turns to the camera slightly moments before he's shot. He's actually a 16-year-old boy, and he's her son. She hadn't seen him since 1995. She assumed that he had died in the massacre. The Srebrenica massacre of more than 7,500 people, but she didn't know. The first she knew of it was when she saw that video on Wednesday night.
Matt Proger, in the seconds we have, how will this affect the trial of Milosevic?
Well, it's obviously further evidence, I think, that the Serbian state apparatus was involved in atrocities in the Bosnian War. Certainly that is the argument of the Hague war crimes prosecutors. The Scorpions paramilitary unit, which is featured, is a part of, or was a part of, the Serbian Ministry of Interior. So these men would appear to have been seconded to the Bosnian War to fight for Bosnian Serb forces from the Serbian government itself.
Matt Prager reports for the BBC in Belgrade in the former Yugoslavia. Matt, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
In the Stalinist Soviet Union, civilians were forced into labor camps because of what they believed. Those camps were called gulags. Now the detention center in Guantanamo Bay is being called the Gulag of Our Times. That explosive charge appears in the foreword to Amnesty International's annual report on human rights abuses around the world. The influential group is calling for the U.S. to shut down the detention center and is also calling for an independent investigation into the abuse and torture of prisoners at U.S.-run facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here's President Bush.
I'm aware of the Amnesty International report, and it's absurd. It's an absurd allegation.
Vice President Dick Cheney added his voice, saying he was offended by the Amnesty report. Joshua Rubenstein is the Northeast Regional Director for Amnesty International. He joins me here in the studio. And do you stand by using the word gulag to describe the detention center at Guantanamo?
Well, it's not the word I would use. I think it probably is hyperbolic. But the real question is, what are the facts on the ground? Ever since the photographs were released from Abu Ghraib just over a year ago, the international community has been alerted to the fact that there is a systematic pattern of abuse and torture at U.S. detention centers in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Guantanamo Bay. That's the question. This involves waterboarding, the use of electric shock, severe beatings, sexual abuse, sleep deprivation, different forms of humiliation. These are clearly instances of mistreatment and torture.
Well, Josh, and we want to talk more about what is in the report, but I don't think we can go that quickly past the use of the word gulag, because a lot of even your supporters are saying that because of that word, what's in the report is being obscured.
Well, I don't think so. It's just one word used in the foreword. There's a sizable entry in the annual report of one of 149 entries on different countries.
Well, I want to hold you up because the Bush administration is focusing on that word, and I think we need a definition. And one is found in Anne Applebaum's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Gulag, A History. She says, gulags are camps constructed to incarcerate people not for what they've done, but for what they are, whole populations and civilians, not soldiers, who would go to prison camps. The Bush administration would say they are detaining people they sincerely believe are combatants. It is a prison camp, not a gulag.
Well, look, in fact, hundreds of people have been released from Guantanamo, for example, and it's clear that they were picked up on false pretenses. The administration had no evidence that they were involved in the insurgency or in 9/11 or any of those conspiracies. There was a famous example of three prisoners released to England, and they were immediately sent home to their families. So why were they picked up in the first place and held without charges?
Because the Bush administration would say, and we are going to have someone responding to Amnesty International in a moment, that there was a sincere suspicion that they were terrorists, that they were combatants. Isn't there a difference between that and a widespread sweep of civilians who may have no attachment to any?
Well, I think that's really the question here, because if there's a genuine due process going on that sorts out the bad guys from the innocent people, that would be less of a problem. But our contention is that in Iraq and among the prisoners in Guantanamo, our people are picked up because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, because perhaps they were arrested at the suggestion of the Northern Alliance, who are trying to get rid of some of their own opponents. That's why you have trial proceedings. That's why you have lawyers, so that a government, any government, including the U.S., has an obligation to present evidence why it's holding someone. Now, we all know that after 9/11, there was severe anxiety and that we needed an investigation. We wanted to prevent another attack. And yes, the administration needed some slack in that atmosphere. But here we are 3 and 4 years later, severe, genuine evidence of mistreatment and torture, people held without trial. That's the issue here for us.
Does Amnesty International ever accept that there might be collateral damage, which is the phrase that we've become used to, that Thomas Friedman, for instance, writes 100 people may have died at Guantanamo, that kind of a loss might be the price that has to be paid in this new territory that the U.S. is in?
I don't want to be in a position of bargaining over how much collateral damage is acceptable. It's a tragedy every time it happens. Every war has collateral damage. The question is our government or any government acting in good faith to limit that collateral damage to work in good faith to sort out people who are genuinely terrorists and engaged in criminal activity and violence as part of this insurgency, and those who are not. And we would say that they've given themselves too much slack. Then when you look at the photographs from Abu Ghraib, you look at the circumstances surrounding the arrest of many of these people, the way the interrogations were conducted, when you talk to someone like Eric Saar, who was an American translator in Cuba at Guantanamo, wrote a book, Inside the Wire, who came away thoroughly disillusioned. He saw beatings, he saw sexual abuse, he saw interrogators who were not prepared professionally to carry out these interrogations. Then you realize that there's more going on here that meets the eye.
Well, now Amnesty International calling for an independent investigation into these abuses that you claim in your report. What would you like to see?
Well, you know, in today's New York Times, there's an article that two sergeants have been charged in Iraq with prison abuse for threatening prisoners with dogs. And it says that they were told it was okay to do by their commander, Thomas Pappas. And yet he's only received the most modest of reprimands, and he will not be subject to a criminal investigation. I thought that kind of small article in the Times today illustrates the problem here. Low-ranking officers are being held responsible. Commanders really are not. Mr. Rumsfeld is not. The high officials in the Department of Justice are Mr. Gonzalez, who wrote memos with these contrived arguments justifying the use of torture, why the president could order the use of torture in his capacity as commander-in-chief. These people have ultimate responsibility. We think there's a connection between their memos, their policy recommendations, and what has gone on in these detention centers.
Well, and am I understanding some of the statements from Amnesty International officials correctly? Are you actually calling on other governments to arrest high-ranking U.S. officials if they travel to other countries?
We are saying that if the U.S. fails to organize a proper investigation from the top down over those responsible for these abuses, then American officials, like any official of any other government, is subject to the provisions of the Convention Against Torture. Pinochet was indicted by a Spanish judge. And if there's no proper investigation of Rumsfeld and others, and if other governments wish to exercise their prerogative under the Convention Against Torture to investigate them or issue an indictment, then Mr. Rumsfeld has been forewarned.
Are you comparing Donald Rumsfeld to Augusto Pinochet, who is indicted for overseeing the murder of his own citizens?
Well, did Mr. Rumsfeld and other people in the administration justify the use of torture? Is there a connection between their memos and the mistreatment and torture we know occurred and probably is still occurring in these detention centers? That's why you need a commission of inquiry to figure that out. But I believe that there is prima facie evidence that they did advocate a policy of torture, and that is illegal under U.S. law and under international law.
And that's Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. We're going to have much more with Josh in just a moment, but while we're on the topic of human rights, this news note, the U.S. State Department is pointing the finger at one of its key allies in the Middle East today, Saudi Arabia, calling it one of the world's worst offenders in human trafficking. The State Department's fifth annual report on what it calls modern-day slavery came out late this morning. It downgrades Saudi Arabia to the lowest category of countries, meaning that it and 13 other countries could be sanctioned for not fully complying with standards set in U.S. law. Thousands of Asians work as domestic servants and laborers in Saudi Arabia. So there you have it, a lot of fingers being pointed today. Stay with us, much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking with Joshua Rubenstein of Amnesty International about that group's recent report on human rights abuses around the world, specifically abuses by the United States in the so-called war on terrorism. And Joshua, you've just detailed many of the group's charges, but we come back to Amnesty's use of the word gulag to characterize Guantanamo Bay, because your critics are pointing to that as evidence that the whole report is wrong and that it's overly hostile to the U.S. given other countries' failings. So has Amnesty shot itself in the foot by a equating the detention of suspected terrorists with a Soviet-run prison system where millions of civilians, Soviet civilians, were worked to death?
Well, let's be candid here. Our report has entries on 149 different countries. There are significant entries on Egypt and Syria where the U.S. is sending, is by its own account, sending people, sending prisoners under this process of extraordinary rendition.
This is another one of your criticisms, that detainees have been subcontracted out for torture.
Well, it's outsourcing torture. And Congressman Markey from our area has a bill, which we support, that would ban the use of extraordinary rendition. It seems to me these are the issues that we are highlighting. The administration wants to focus on what they can perceive as the misuse of the word gulag and have people be distracted from the issue of the facts on the ground.
And I guess your supporters are also saying that it was an unfortunate use for just that reason, because it gives them that ammunition.
Well, but the fact is that we are getting a great deal more attention. People are looking at the report. They're seeing beyond the use of the word gulag, and they're questioning the administration's policies. That's really the issue here. Since 9/11, I understand, we all understand the anxiety in response to that attack and the war and the violence going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean that our administration, our government, should be beyond an honest inquiry into its actions. In a democracy, a government should be held accountable by the people. And we believe that too many of these investigations have been a whitewash, they have not gone far enough, and they have let the commanders and the political leadership off the hook. That's the issue here.
Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. Joshua, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, for reaction to Amnesty International's report, we turn to Commander Glenn Solmacy. He's a military man, but speaking on his own behalf as an associate professor of law at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. And Commander, your thoughts on the Amnesty report?
I'll tell you, Robin, it was, for me, I was caught off guard. And I think the best way to describe it is disappointed. I think Amnesty provides and has provided through the decades tremendous support for human rights throughout the world. And I think in the new global war on terror, we have to recognize this is a new type of war. And I think there is a tremendous need for non-governmental organizations like Amnesty to be key players in the fight. Unfortunately, this report made one suspect maybe of their objectivity, in particular, referring to our men and women who are guarding folks in Guantanamo Bay and other bases around the world as being analogous to the gulag, which was particularly offensive.
We just spoke to Josh Rubenstein of Amnesty's office here in Boston. He agrees that the use of the word gulag was inappropriate, but the organization as a whole is standing by the word. Your thoughts?
I think it's disappointing. It's unfortunate. I think if you stop and the American men and women who are providing liberty to people in Afghanistan, women are voting in Afghanistan, the liberation movement in Iraq, the Middle East process is moving. I mean, Israel today made a significant gesture of releasing 400 detainees. There's significant movement in the area of being positive and freedom and liberty, and you have something like this say that those men and women who are fighting for this liberty are somehow analogous to gulag-type activity or analogous to the Stalinist communist regimes. That's disappointing. It's factually incorrect.
But on the other hand, do you think that some people are maybe seizing on this word as a way of distracting from real problems that the U.S. have at these detention centers, and that some high-ranking officials in particular are using the word to sort of escape criticism of their involvement in what's happening at the detention centers?
Well, certainly there is always that possibility, but we say that there are these reports. None of these are really substantiated. When you stop and look at the Lesson 18 of the Al-Qaeda training manual that actually tells the prisoners what to say at prison and detention centers. One of them is complain of mistreatment while in prison.
Well, columnist Thomas Friedman quotes others
and
says that 100 people have died at Guantanamo.
Right.
Amnesty International isn't the only group calling for, you know, a bipartisan investigation of prisoner abuse.
And I think if we stop and look at what has transpired and what we're the focus of how this all took place, we have to go back and recognize that the folks that we are fighting against in the war on terror are folks who are dedicated to destroying our way of life. And actually, I haven't seen many reports emphasizing the folks, the beheadings in Iraq and other areas that I think our focus may be misplaced. Certainly, there have been mistakes made in certain places, as in as we know in Abu Ghraib. But the key thing, I think, from a human rights and international law perspective is that it's not the policy of the United States to engage in these sorts of activities, where other nation states, other organizations, their policy, their programs are engaged in violating human rights. It's part of their dogma.
Well, but what about the thinking that America should be held to a higher standard?
Yes, ma'am. And I think their value in trying to hold the United States to a higher standard is appropriate. And I think the U.S. has met that in many regards, and in most regards. If we actually look at some of the 24,000 interrogations that have taken place at Guantanamo, I believe seven were confirmed by the Inspector General of the Navy as being potentially abusive in some nature, and of those, all were construed as being minor. The Red Cross is allowed to visit with the detainees in these prison cells in Guantanamo, so there has been efforts on behalf of our government to meet that higher standards, and I think that's the distinction, Robin. The policy of the U.S. government is not to engage in activity that is contrary to international law.
But do you ever worry that it is a part of policy? Amnesty International points to former Assistant Attorney General J.S. Beebe, who argued in a 2002 Justice Department memorandum that it is permissible to inflict pain as long as it is less than the pain associated with organ failure or death. He's now a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right. I mean, that's a great point, Robin. I think what we have to look to is that this is a new type of war. When those documents were written, it was in 2001, we're engaging in a new type of warfare. You have this sort of dynamic where now it's different. And I think our rules maybe need to be updated, and an aggressive nature of the diplomatic and international law community should be seeking a means to achieve some of these ambiguities that exist within our laws and codes right now in international law.
Glenn Salmasi is an associate professor of law at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. Commander Salmasi, thanks so much for speaking with us.
I really appreciate it, Robin. Have a great day.
Next week on Here and Now, inside the minds of suicide bombers, are they motivated by religious fervor, political anger? Are they insane? Also, what do other whistleblowers think of W. Mark Felt? Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Book editors and publishers gathered in New York this week for the annual Book Expo America, and there's good news for the old media. Over the last 3 years, consumer spending on books rose by 8%, even as movies, TV, and the recording industry stay in steady decline. And we've just started the big book season, summer. Ah, summer. Somehow the word still carries the impress of a time by the lake, the river, the sea, the ocean, or the pool, when the faces around you were familiar, the money in your hands couldn't buy much more than a chocolate-dipped cone, and the days had no hours. I wish they were my words, but they're not. They're the words of Liesl Schillinger. She reviews three new novels about summer for the highly anticipated Sunday New York Times Summer Reading Book Review. It comes out this weekend, but we've got a sneak preview from the Times Book Review editor, Sam Tannenhaus. Sam, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Now, to the summer novels first, there are three that are reviewed in one section. And the one that jumped out at me, Michael Burns' Childhood at Oriole. It was actually first published in 1951.
That's right, and the author is now 93, and he was a reporter for the Times of London. His name is Michael Byrne, who actually covered Edward VIII's abdication to the throne, and here he is still with us. And it's a novel that really impressed Liesl, who's one of our best critics, and I think she evokes very well what the book does. It captures that interwar period in England, which is a period that always fascinates Americans, mm-hmm. and this is a novel worth looking at.
Michael Burns' Childhood at Oriole. And by the way, we'll have all the books that we talk about on our website, but I know people are taking notes, so the two other summer novels, Beth Gutchian's Leeway Cottage, that's set in a fictional seaside town in Maine, and The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake, Steve Amick's first novel, set in the summer of 2001 in Michigan's Northern Lake District. So you cover all the bases. But Sam, I have to say, my favorite book in the entire issue is in the section devoted to travel books. It's called The Clumsiest People in Europe, about, the writings of what seems like a very unhappy person.
Well, our reviewer, Henry Alford, says that she may even be nastier than Simon Cowell. On the other hand, at least as amusing as he is. And, you know, the British have been doing this for a long time, writing these eccentric travel books that emphasize everything but what you expect to find. Irritable bowel syndrome in this case, and the displeasures of travel. And this book captures that especially well.
The title again, The Clumsiest People in Europe, or Mrs. Mortimer's Bad-Tempered Guide to the Victorian World, the gathered writings of Mrs. Favell Lee Mortimer, a woman who led a life of utter misery. Well, moving on, an irritating person is at the center of a gardening book, of all things, a Nicholas Shulman's Portrait of Gardener Reginald Farrar. It's called A Rage for Rock Gardening.
Yes, Reginald Farrar, the malevolent gnome, we're told, who apparently wrote these world-transforming gardening books. he created a sort of vocabulary for writing about gardening that hadn't existed before, and he became really an important and influential writer.
His books, My Rock Garden, written in 1907, The Rock Garden, written in 1912, and The English Rock Garden, written in 1919. But she weaves, in addition to his gardening advice, you know, information about him, and as she writes, a malevolent gnome with a wish to be fascinating but an ill-restrained bitterness of tongue.
Yes, that's right. And somehow, as Verlin Klinkenberg says in his review, that malevolence transcends itself in the writing and becomes the basis for very acute and careful writing about gardens.
What jumps out for you from the issue?
Well, there's a new novel by Paul Theroux, who is one of America's more important writers. Our reviewer, Hari Kundru, is a newer British novelist of some renown, and his take on Theroux is one readers will find interesting. He is struck somewhat by Theroux self-absorption and by some of the tics in his writing. He mentions, for instance, that Theroux has a very acute ear for mispronounced English by foreigners, and so there are all sorts of examples of that. On the other hand, what Theroux was able to do is to pull you into the drama of his life and his own obsessions, and he does it in a very mesmerizing way. And this is a novel that longtime readers of Theroux who know his travel work will find evocative. It's set in an Ecuadorian rainforest, and the hero is someone who's kind of escaping from his literary life into this other world.
Paul Theroux's new book, it's called Trespassing. Put that on the list as well. There is a page of recommended summer cookbooks. I noticed one, it's called Salmon, and it's just about salmon. That's from Diane Morgan. And for nonfiction, I noticed Early Bird. This is Rodney Rothman, who moves into a retirement community in Florida with people twice his age. And what I noticed in the review is that even though he once wrote for David Letterman, there's not an ounce of meanness in the book.
Well, it's also a kind of a nice story, because what Rothman has done is to pretend to be an old person and to explore what that life is like. And it's a very clever conceit, because most of us know, or older people or older ourselves, and wonder what retirement holds for us. And so he investigates that almost as a foreign country, a different state of being, and reports back. Mm-hmm. A charming book.
Sam Tannenhaus of the New York Times Book Review telling us about this Sunday's issue, which is devoted to summer reading. And you know, Sam, I'm wondering, overall, it doesn't seem, at least in this issue, that there's a blockbuster yet, but is one on the horizon?
Well, Bob Woodward's book is said to be on its way, being rushed into print, we're told, in July.
Of course, because
now that Deep Throat has been unmasked,
right,
or dethroated or whatever. David McCullough's book, 1776, which is a departure for him because it describes just one year in the life of the country. Of course, it's our most famous year, I suppose. And also has a somewhat anti-heroic view of George Washington. That book is leaping to the top of the bestseller list, I can tell you, next week. So that's a big book. There are others on the way. John Irving has a new novel coming out. Cormac McCarthy does as well. The summer tends to be a little slower for the major literary writers. They tend to be published in the fall and spring, but there are some significant books on the way.
Well, Sam Tannenhaus, I'm going to do one last thing before I let you go. Obviously, you've got the issue coming out this Sunday, but I want to know your personal recommendation for summer reading. Pick a book.
Oh, gosh, what am I reading that I'm really enjoying? I'll tell you, it's actually a book I'm going to be writing about for the book review, which is something I've not done since I've been here. It's a collection of Hollywood writings by a wonderful American writer, Daniel Fuchs, who died about a dozen years ago, mm-hmm, after a productive but kind of obscure career. He mingled screenwriting, which he did very successfully, with very artful and ambitious fiction writing, magazines like The New Yorker, and a publisher, David Godin, has brought together some of his collected pieces on Hollywood that I think will be of real interest to readers. I recommend them very highly.
Sam Tannenhaus, editor of the Sunday New York Times Book Review. This Sunday, the entire issue is devoted to summer reading. Sam, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
And happy reading.
Same to you.
And he reads all the bad ones, so we don't have to. Well, for a list of all the books we discussed, don't forget, you can go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Beijing is building new sports facilities and refurbishing old ones for the 2008 Summer Olympics. To make way for the $42 billion project, the city has evicted 300,000 people from their homes. Many received little compensation, and those who complained were either ignored or jailed. Only a Games' Bill Littlefield talked with John Powers, who covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe, and asked if a host city's ever done as much as Beijing is doing in preparing for the Games.
Nothing of this scale. I remember in 1980 when Moscow held the Games, what was called, the Russians called a chistka, a cleansing, where they basically got all of the undesirables out of sight. But in terms of massive urban renewal, this is huge. And I think what you're seeing more and more now is the Olympics as an excuse to get urban renewal done. That's a little bit of that in New York, for example.
The undesirables were gotten out of sight, supposedly, in Atlanta as well, and certainly at the Olympics in Australia, the Sydney Olympics, there was a lot of protest, but people who protested weren't jailed in the past.
That's right. This is unusual, and I think it does show you the level to which Beijing really needs this to happen and really will do whatever it takes. When the IOC first came around looking, before Beijing ever got the bid, they were very concerned about the pollution. And the Chinese said, no problem, we'll just shut down all the factories for a couple months.
Well, the IOC has just completed its fourth inspection of Beijing. Have they had any response to what's going on over there?
If anything, the only concern was that Beijing might be done too early. As a matter of fact, that was the joke before the Athens Games, which city would be done earlier, Beijing or Athens? But from what the IOC said, they showed no concerns about mass evictions. They showed no concerns about any of the other issues, for example, like human rights, which is still an ongoing issue there. As far as the IOC is, I mean, basically, if everything's built on time, that's all they care about.
Bloomberg News Service has reported that the Beijing Olympics could be the most profitable ever. Do you get a gold medal for that now?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that was the choice of Beijing was wildly applauded by U.S. sponsors that have been looking to open up the Chinese market.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, it's much more urgent and much more available now than it was even when Beijing got the Games back in 2001.
Gone are the days when the aspirations of those organizing the Olympics were to break even, because after all, this was about the ideal of competition, not about making money.
Well, all that ended when Montreal had a massive deficit in 1976, and the idea was at least to be able to break even. What was interesting is that after all of the fuss, Athens actually made a profit of 7 million euros. So there's a feeling if Athens can do it, Beijing can certainly do it.
And L.A., of course, set the standard for that back in the day, right? That was the first time somebody ever really discovered the Olympics as a massive money-making opportunity.
Yes, and I think what was interesting about that was that one reason why L.A. did it was a lot of the buildings were already there. What is new is to build things from scratch and still turn a profit. But all indications are that the Beijing Games will be a spectacular success by the way they are defined by sponsors in the IOC.
Well, that brings us back to another question about Beijing. 300,000 people evicted from their homes. Are any of these people going to find new homes in what's built to accommodate the Olympics?
It seems unlikely. Generally, when new apartments are built, new housing is built, it becomes upscale housing. And if anything, from what we have seen in Beijing and other large Chinese cities, there's a boom in the middle class and in the upper middle class that did not exist perhaps even 10 years ago. So there is a sense that it will be a very new face to Beijing, both in terms of what it looks like and who's living there.
Let's move on to New York. The city's hopes to host the 2012 Games received a boost yesterday when the state Supreme Court dismissed Cablevision's assertion of illegality in the purchase of land on Manhattan's west side. How much does this affect Gotham's chances to land the Games in 2012?
Well, it at least takes one of the issues away, which is the public opposition. But the larger issue is, can they get it through the state legislature? And both the Assembly Speaker and the Senate President have been balking, and the legislature appears to not get the same sense of urgency that the mayor and the governor do. Of course, what is interesting is that next week the IOC will issue its report. Basically, there is an IOC commission that checks out all of the bidders. And New York is very concerned that if they don't have a stadium proposal done by then, it will really hurt their chances.
One hopes that the organizers in New York won't decide to take their lessons from China.
Exactly.
John Powers covers all things Olympic for the Boston Globe. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And John Powers spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard came onto the music scene with quite a pedigree. He learned music from his opera-singing father. Another early teacher in New Orleans was Ellis Marsalis, whose son Wynton recommended Terrence to be his replacement when Wynton left Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. As a solo artist, Terrence Blanchard has written most of the soundtracks for film director Spike Lee, and his last CD, Bounce, was hailed by critics as his masterpiece. Well, now, 2 years later, Blanchard is back with a new CD, Flow. That's Flow Part 1 from Terrence Blanchard's new CD, Flow, on Blue Note Records. It arrives in stores next Tuesday and was produced by Herbie Hancock. Terrence Blanchard joins us now from the NPR studios of WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. And I'm thinking you're in your hometown.
I'm in my hometown relaxing. I have about a month off before I start touring, and it's been great.
Good for you. How much does New Orleans play into you? How you play?
It plays a very significant role. I mean, you know, I grew up listening to all of these great musicians here as a kid. And one of the things that I've always loved about the musicians here is that a lot of the guys that I grew up hearing, they just were great musicians and they did it for the pure love of it.
And your story is a lot about kids listening in and then suddenly sitting in and then suddenly being part of the band, you included. And I'm thinking you're now the artistic director at the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz Performance at the University mm-hmm. of Southern California. Mm-hmm. This is a 2-year college-level program, free for a select group of really lucky musicians. How much fun is that to work with these young kids coming up?
It's an amazing experience for myself as well as the students. You know, Herbie Hancock is the director of the program. Mm-hmm. I'm the artistic director of the program. So I'm dealing with the kids 1 week out of every month. And the only thing that we ask for them is a 2-year commitment just to be there and really focus hard and work hard on their craft.
Yeah, what a gift. Well, and we understand that conversations there with Herbie Hancock led to the creation of the CD. What'd you talk about?
One of the things Herbie always talks about is like, whatever happened to the cutting-edge philosophy of being a jazz musician, always trying something new, trying to push the envelope in new directions. And that opened my eyes to a lot of things in terms of just the guys in my band, their compositions, and their vision.
And your new CD, Flow, is the result. Let's listen to Herbie Hancock playing piano on the song, The Source. Terrence Blanchard, as we listen to Herbie Hancock play on your new CD. Also in the band, Liana Lueke from
Benin.
From Benin. He plays yes. guitar and sings. Mm-hmm. And he is one of the kids you met at the Monk Institute.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about your reaction to his sound.
I still remember his audition for the program like it was yesterday, because when he came in, he started to play some percussive stuff on his instrument. Then he started to sing, and we were all sitting there going, what is this guy doing? But then he led the band into this particular composition that we had called, and then he played a great solo on it, and he still had his own very distinctive style in doing it. And I remember Herbie was blown away, I was blown away, and we said, we got to have this guy no matter what.
Have him at the Institute and then have him on a CD.
Oh, yeah. Well, once he was at the school, you know, my mind was working from day one.
Well, see, I'm catching on here. This the Thelonious Monk Institute acts as a farm school for your band.
No. He's the only guy from the school that I've hired so far. But, I mean, the program itself is amazing because a lot of the kids have gone on to do a lot of great things all over the place.
Well, let's listen to, is it again, Lionel Lueke?
Lueke.
Lueke, a guitarist. He's central to a 15-minute sort of mini suite mm-hmm. on your new CD. It's called Wadagbe. Mm-hmm. It's got a real, you know, sound of West Africa with a modern groove to it. Let's listen. ¶¶ Terrence Blanchard. It's called Flow. Terrence, we were talking earlier about Herbie Hancock, talks about, you know, where's the edge in jazz, who's going to push it forward. You're regarded as one of the finest trumpeters in jazz and one who does push jazz forward. But what does that mean to you?
What it means is just constantly searching for things and not being afraid of what you find. I've been lucky in that I've had great relationships with very talented young musicians who I consider to be visionaries. You know, these guys in the band, like, they play stuff in 11 and 13 like it's playing, like they're playing 4/4.
Could you beat out 11, 13, and 4/4 for us, for those who aren't musicians, so they could hear how complicated that is?
Right now?
Yeah.
I can't even remember the compositions right now in my head because I'm still hearing Wild Duck Bay in my mind.
Okay.
But if you listen to Harvesting Dance, you know, that's in 11.
Terrence Blanchard, I'm also thinking that there's some romance on Flow. I mean, when I say that, I mean, you know, I have very wonderful memories of my parents' first stereo, the mellow sounds of Harry James. Do you have those early memories of that kind of trumpet?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, when I listen to Miles Davis play, the thing that has always amazed me about his playing was his sound and how he could play just a couple of notes and really touch your soul. And I'm very fortunate that Derek has brought a tune like Over There to the band, because the tune itself is just a very strong and powerful and emotional experience. One of the things that I always do whenever we play that thing is I have to gear myself up for the emotional roller coaster ride that we're about to embark on whenever we play it.
Because
it's the kind of thing where you get engrossed in the movement of the composition. It's not like, you know, you sit down and say, oh, I'm going to play it this way tonight. That thing actually starts to grow and build all by itself. And I think a lot of it has to do with just the thought of what the tune is about. You know, when I asked Derek about the title, he said, well, Over There is really about how in life we always think that we have a better job, a better relationship, better house over there, and we never really appreciate what we have.
Song About Longing from Derek Hodge, the bass player in Terrence Blanchard's band. Let's listen Over There from the CD Flow. Blanchard, it's a beautiful emotional song. I could feel that too.
We've played that thing and people have come up to us and said, man, I would love to cry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing tune.
Jazz trumpeter Terrence Blanchard. His new CD, Flow, arrives in stores next week. For more information, check out our website at here-now.org. Terrence, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.